Start then? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure thing.
All right. Sorry, just give me a second. Hi, Alyssa. Thank you so much for taking the time. Even though you have COVID, you were gracious enough to be on this episode. So thank you so much for doing that.
Oh, thank you.
Great. Talking about big investigative projects. You have written multiple books, and I would like to probably go over them, one by one, maybe if we have enough time.
Okay, wow.
So the first one that I think you wrote, going back 20 years, is Branded: The Buying and Selling of Teenagers. Can you talk about why you decided to write that book, and what kind of motivated you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always say to my students when I used to teach journalism that everybody has a sentence, you know, like a sentence that defines their writing. It's sort of the sentence, the quest, like what are they looking for? And you can see it reflected in their every piece of work they do. And I think my sentence is, where does the individual meet the economy? Where does the family meet the economy? Where do childhood meet the economy? Like I'm so really interested in the intersection of social class and be what it means to be human in a certain period, like the inner life of money, let's say. The inner life of money. That's what I'm interested in, and class. So that was the start of it. I was unconscious that was gonna that I was unconscious that was my sentence and that was what I was interested in. But it turned out it was what I was interested in. I just wanted to follow what I was seeing, which is like there was a huge race in the late 90s and early noughts to get teens' dollars. This was the millennial generation that we now know was enormous and defined buying patterns in America. But then they were just teenagers, and actually the term millennial was defined by like a Madison Avenue and advertising team. I went to conferences where they were just starting to use the word millennial back then. And they were aiming at them. It was very strategic. They were looking for, they were creating ketchups they'd like and yogurts they'd like. They were creating plans where they'd get the teens to sell to other teens in high schools wearing fleece and, oh, look at my fleece or look at my Abercrombie or look at my outfit and listen to this band. It wasn't NSYNC, it was a Backstreet Boys kind of band. And I talked to the people who would sell that band to their friends in high school. And at that point, they were using either, word of mouth and, by the lockers or in the hallways, or they'd be saying these things to them online in early, MySpace, like early social media sites. And it was pretty intense just to see the ways that suddenly young people were defining themselves through things. I remember one kid said to me, I am Pepsi. Another said, I am Abercrombie. Like they would see themselves through brands. And I found that a little worrisome and also a little fascinating. I thought the whole process of them selling stuff to each other was really interesting. Obviously, that has expanded exponentially. Now you have the influencers, you have people on Instagram who are paid to sell, teenagers and tweens even who are paid to sell stuff to each other. So, I mean, if I ever did a follow-up to Branded, again, it was like before, it was like early on in the curve, I think there'd be a whole other book to write about what happened later about that kind of identification. At that point, it was still sort of shocking that a magazine would run things that looked like editorial and were actually advertising. They called it advertorial back then. Now it's like really normal, right? You have clickable ads in mainstream publications and paid content and paid content sort of seamlessly woven into, I'm not going to say name names, but it's like almost everybody, right? Lifestyle kind of advertising content that looks like the real McCoy of a publication. And teenagers don't know the difference. L little kids don't. My kid doesn't. My kid's like, oh, look, there's an article saying I should buy these pants. And it's like, no, it's actually, so that's paid content. So this was all the beginning of that. And I was just sort of fascinated about what it was doing psychologically to kids and the role their parents had in it. And like, basically some of these kids were replicating their parents' tendencies and their parents' anxieties. So that's how I started.
So, is there an alternative to this? I mean, what I'm trying to ask you is, what would make you happy? Like, in the sense that, would no advertising, or you know, would you want that all brands be stopped for children, like advertisement to children, or would you be happy when children don't buy anything which is of a particular brand? Or I'm just trying to understand, like,
what right, like, what's the goal here?
Yeah, what's the best case scenario where you would be, you know, you would probably not release that book, where you know you feel that it's everything is good and yeah.
Well, I think it's gotten so much worse that it looks almost quaint when I look back at my case studies. I mean, the level of, you know, intra sales, you know, the ways that commercial culture has just slipped into childhood is ineffably is like off the charts now. So I think I know if anything, it was kind of a canary in the mine, like this is happening and it just got worse and worse. So what would make me happy? I think, again, awareness is really important, especially for teenagers, for them to recognize, and children that they're being sold to, and what content is, it's like media criticism, you know, what content is advertising, what content is editorial, what is something that your friend is telling you to buy because they have a, you know, they're going to get some, you know, I don't know, some special perk from the company or free gear or swag if they tell you they like it. Like, to clarify those relationships, to make things transparent for kids, to have parents modeling that. I think this, so some of it happens on the individual level, and the broader social level, I mean, the genie's sort of out of the bottle, except one of the things that's interesting is that now you can obviously stream stuff. So advertising has gotten more subtle in some ways, but in other ways you could have your kid just watch something and not encounter an ad at all, which was not mm-hmm. possible in 1999. You know, my daughter, we watch streaming stuff, and yeah, I'm sure there's product placement and there's all kinds of like subliminal messages that have been paid for by advertisers, but it's not like the constant cheesy ads that kids in the 90s and early noughts had to watch, right? So that's an advantage. In Sweden, I think they didn't have ads in children's television until 5 o'clock. That seemed incredibly easy, elegant solution. Just don't have ads for children, aimed at children, until 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. I think when you were promoting this book, I think back in the early 2000s, I think you gave an interview, and the interviewer asked you, I don't think you remember this one as well, let me just, so she asked you, ultimately, what should be done? And you answered, quote, there could be more regulation for advertisements for kids under 12, and then there are the schools. They'll get a teacher to get kids to fill out a questionnaire about what juices they drink or whatever. There should be more limits to that, and everyone should understand what that means. And on the web, there is a lot of solicitation of information. There should be more monitors on corporate practices on the internet aimed toward kids under 17, end quote. In today's world, I think...
You know, actually, I want to correct this. I just was checking the Swedish law. It's against the law in Sweden to send direct mail advertising addressed to children under the age of 16. And it also forbids the broadcasting of television commercials aimed at children under 12 per se, food or toys. So that's, I mean, God, can you imagine that happening? It couldn't happen in India either, but that level of regulation. And indeed, like, yeah, the transparency again, like in schools are part of it. I mean, I haven't been watching, I was following for many years, right, the companies that were paying for advertising in school handouts, you know, curriculum, but they would have little ads. so like, it'd be like Mary and Joseph ad apples, and then it'd be like, you know, buy this apple juice. Seriously, it would have like an ad for the company in the handouts. And these were struggling schools who were getting these handouts and workbooks because from the companies, and it was seen as this, oh yeah, so what? I have to look at these ads. But to me, that was so telling and horrifying, right? So that's the kind of thing, obviously, we should be very aware of. There was a lot of pressure at some points to, I think it was in New York during the Bloomberg administration to remove things like soda machines from schools, right? Because this is part of the obesity epidemic, but also it was, you know, another way to get brands into schools. Like companies would do this in all kinds of schools, and they'd pay for their sports equipment, and they'd get, you know, insignias for the companies onto the school buildings, you know. So this was a thing that was happening, like, I don't know, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think that, again, probably if I follow this up, the genie's out of the bottle with that as well. So, but yeah, I mean, and honestly, some of the things that are happening in the U.S. around children's tax credits and just things that support families are ultimately going to support, I wouldn't say anti-branding or unbranding or brand consciousness, but I think it's going to support, you know, a healthy relationship, a healthier relationship within families and a less anxious relationship to money and to each other. And that could only, lead to less covetous feelings. I mean, I think part of the covetousness around brands for teens and children is always this sort of sense of economic desperation in this country, which is not necessarily an accurate reflection of what people are financially, where they're at. But, you know, status markers are really important, right? So kids pick up on this, they're absorbing this. And, you know, more support for families so they're less, so there's less of that kind of anxiety would probably mean that a kid wouldn't have to get the sneakers that exhibit their, you know, power and money, you know, well, in fact, at home, they can't really afford anything, which is still happening, right? You go into any high school classroom or lower school classroom, you have kids sort of flaunting their backpacks and their expensive pants and things. But you wonder if there was more support for families, would there be that kind of anxiety? I mean, I guess somebody could say it's just human nature to want to have status, and this is one way that kids express it. But it's certainly gotten earlier and earlier. I mean, it's now, when I wrote Branded, it sort of started around 12, and now it seems to be starting around 9, like showing each other their sneakers and backpacks and leggings and, you know, fidget spinners and, you know, video games and, you know, skateboards, right? And feeling like they have to have more and more of the brand name things to be okay.
So in that book, if I'm not, and please stop me if I'm wrong. But if I understand correctly, you know, part of the blame you placed on that book was on companies who are doing this, this advertisement. Again, I'm trying to understand what would make you happy in the sense that would you be happy if the companies just did not advertise, let's say for backpacks or, for shoes, for kids? Is that what you're looking for? Is this a problem that you think that has no solution per se, but the more people talk about this and, you know, the more people realize that it's a problem, we've done our job.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm one of these people who think that books, like these kind of books, can serve as, I call it radical self-help, whereas people can sort of read them and learn how to think about their experience and how to parent differently, maybe, or how to teach differently. So some of this is really going to happen on the familial and this educational level, right? Where maybe a part of the health curriculum could be talking about commodities and stuff, right? It could be not just talking about puberty or, you know, germs or whatever you're talking about in your health class, right? When kids are growing up, you could also be diversity, other kinds of diversity. You could also talk about material diversity, like what people can afford and what that means. And is it really important to have five of what, you know, the brand name thing? What role do brands serve psychologically and emotionally for kids? You know, and what work are they doing in the classroom? Can we try to demystify them? Can we try to not talk about them? I guess, I don't know. Yeah, there could be a dream of everybody wearing brand-free clothing. I mean, I think sometimes schools have assumed uniforms for that reason. But from what I hear, though, often the kids will try to make class distinctions within the uniform. Like they'll be wearing the nicest possible sweater over the uniform, or the, so there's an effort to do that. But Yeah. So what would be the end goal? I think it's awareness. I think it's, and this was something that I've written about before. I think it's awareness about, I almost want to reinstate an idea, which is the idea of selling out, which was obviously a major concept in the 60s and 70s and up through the 80s. But I think that's part of the problem, that the teenagers don't think that there is anything wrong with, and this is this started in the 90s, right? This there was a loss of a distinction between advertising culture and news and, you know, culture, personal expression, right? Expression for pure monetary gain and for selling, and expression for other reasons, right? For public interest. And that, so that losing that understanding, I guess one way to see it is that the whole brand culture was an early version of disinformation, because it was like an early confusion around what was real and what was only existed as a kind of promotional copy. And that confusion is part of what has created, you know, young people who are bad media consumers, right? Who make other kinds of errors around politics, around things that you might say are actually really important. But I think it laid the groundwork. Like, if you think that the cartoon Go-Gurt is actually a bit of information aimed at you, or, you know, the bit of promotion in the video game is actually aimed at you, aimed at your pleasure and aimed at your mind, not just aimed at your pocketbook, then you get sort of confused about what's real and what's not in other kinds of media. So, yeah. I mean, I think the aim is the aim of cultural studies in general, which is to create consumers with agency. And I think kids and teenagers can be taught and can teach themselves to have that, because I don't think the companies are obviously going to take the hint. And if anything, what they've done is they've further, and I wrote a piece about this in The Guardian, about the faux woke advertising, which I could send to you, which actually kind of people...
Sure, I'll link it.
You do? Okay, good. That's sort of the final stage, right? Where they recognize that there's these, they have this word now in the teens to describe teens who are heavy environmental consumers, which sounds like a paradox, but it means they buy certain kinds of scrunchies and water bottles and they recycle their clothes. So they're a little more conscious than the teens of yore, but companies know this now, and they do these faux woke advertisements that try to kind of mine their social consciousness, co-opt it, and sell them things through it. So that's sort of the latest stage, I'd say. So I'm not sure it's going anywhere. I guess, to me, the recycling thing, though, would be a sign of, like, on a small scale, people going to get vintage clothes or recognizing that they should, you know, not just new, shiny, but the opposite, that's a good development. And that shows being a consumer with consciousness and with agency.
I want to digress a little bit. Obviously, kids, when they're advertised, may not be able to distinguish between, I mean, what is real and, you know, what is being presented to them. Obviously, I mean, I don't know if it's that obvious, but adults or, you know, generally people who are, you know, in that 18 to 24 category per se, when they look at an ad, probably they do know that, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's marketed by this company so that they can sell more products. But even with that knowledge, people do end up, you know, buying quote unquote overpriced goods, which they might get the same value at a cheaper price. Why do you think people go for, you know, these big brands, or they go for that image? Do you have any thoughts on that, or do you want to just move on?
Why they go for the big brands?
I mean, yeah, I mean,
right. What about, I mean, it? Well, I think it's sort of aligning yourself with power, right? It's like the low glow, the glow around the logo, the it's almost like the aura around it. It's like celebrity or, you know, political power, right? So I think that it's just, and it's also, if it's in your face enough, you'll start to want something, right? It's just the repetition, the bias that's created by repetition. So So I think that, I think it's trying to be close to power. And if you're like a little consumer who feels like they, you know, you can't vote yet, you can't drive yet, you can't do much, but you don't understand everything about the world around you, but you can buy the Nikes or the, you know, whatever. I'm trying to give another latest huge brand here.
Apple.
Yeah. The latest, the iPhone 13 and the Nikes. And then you'll be part of the game, right? You'll be part of society. So I think that the recognition that is the way that you become part of society, not by, you know, learning the Constitution or, you know, or even, you know, fully becoming yourself. It's like it's a shortcut.
Right. So 20 years on, I mean, I think you wrote that book in 2003.
It came out in, I think 2004, the paperback came out. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, when you look at the media landscape today, where most of the services that people use, like Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, are generally ad-supported platforms, and you know, generally kids who are above 12 generally have a smartphone on them, and you know, they are exposed to various. I mean, I would think that the intensity of ads that are shown to a 12-year-old today or a 14-year-old today are much more than, let's say, in 2003, 2004. So in that situation, in that circumstance, like, how do you look at the landscape? Do you have any thoughts on that?
How I look at the landscape of, say that again, I'm sorry.
Of like, I mean, kids being exposed to, you know, so much advertisement, like whenever they are on a free service, let's say YouTube or Instagram or TikTok, they are generally, you know, they are shown multiple ads, and they also have their peer group, you know, their influencer group, who also ask them to buy products, or, you know, ask them to support them by multiple ways. Do you have any thoughts on how the advertisement landscape itself has evolved, per se?
Do I have any thoughts about how the, I mean, I think one of the ways that advertising has evolved is it has these much more, I mean, and this is no surprise, these much more sort of perverse ads where you can't always tell what is being sold, right? That have the element of surprise. They'll have, I could come up with different ones, but they'll have, you know, it looks like it's an ad for a battery and it's actually an ad for life insurance. You know what I mean? And it's using lots of different tones, and it does that because it recognizes that the viewer is probably streaming, has recorded it, you know, and they're going to have to kind of wake up the viewer, surprise them into looking at the ad, right? They don't think that they will stop and look at it. So it's a different impulse. So that's the thing. So like the tonal incongruities, I guess, would be a way, you know, like there aren't really jingles. It's like a different, and as I said before, it's like, there's also this like fake wokeness. I hate the word wokeness, but like, you know what I mean? A fake kind of blue state consciousness in some of them, like eco warriors are celebrated, or girl centered technology. But they're for Airbnb and Kia, and they're kind of, they're ad washing, really. They're sort of greenwashing, they're ad washing these brands, brand washing them, for Verizon, and they'll be sort of pitching liberal values. And part of it is because the consumers are, you know, often now in cities, they're from the professional classes, they're increasingly democratic. And so it's about consumer dollars. And so, you know, obviously you think, oh, the creative class, you know, Whole Foods shopper, but they can get to really ridiculous extremes, and it's still selling, honestly, in a word, crap. It's like that Kendall Jenner Pepsi spot, you know, where there's that, do you remember that?
Not really.
It had like a Black Lives Matter sign. It was just to sell sugar water. They're kind of issue ads, but they do it terribly. Yeah. So like, for instance, like empowering girls becomes like a product unto itself in some of these ads. It's like, that's what they're selling, but it's a red herring because they're really selling laptops.
Do you think that brands slash selling any product is mutually exclusive to them supporting any cause? Do you think they can never go together per se?
No, I wouldn't say that. No, of course not. And I'm sure the people, the great minds, like in super smart people working in advertising, like I know a lot of them, right? They're like, they used to be journalists. I mean, that's part of what happened to a lot of the people you're asking about in your early questions, right? That we went to communications and advertising and writing promotional copy. And yeah, they also want the world to live in harmony, to quote, "I'd like to buy the world a Coke." That was that famous 1971 ad, right? The thing is, if your aim is to really sell stuff, it's the mission is sort of lost. I mean, honestly, it's arguable, right, whether any of this kind of culture does move people besides what making them want to buy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. At this point, I want to move on to your second book. If I understand correctly, it's Hothouse Kids, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thank God.
So, Ryan, have you read every single one of my books?
Not really. I haven't read everyone. I'm so sorry. I am getting to
it. Oh no! Which spoke to you most?
Which? Can you repeat that, ma'am?
Which book spoke to you most?
I read Branded. I just started off with Hothouse Kids. That's why I just wanted to confirm if that was your second book. I'm but yet to read all of your bibliography, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we don't have to go into such depth. I mean, I love that you're talking about these books that I haven't thought about for a while, but... I mean, the things I've been mostly focusing on now are slightly different. I mean, they take the same project, as I said, around family and the individual and how it hits against American income inequality and the American dream and many of the myths that were taught in school, you know, and the corporate culture, like how it deforms and informs who we are. So this is like, I'd say it's almost like at this point, I'm doing my fifth book. It's like they're all pieces. They're like mosaics. It's like a mosaic, and they're all like pieces of the same interest, you know.
Right.
So, like, if we look at and even the show, the radio show. I don't know if you had to listen to that.
Oh, no, not yet.
Yeah. So that was the same too. I mean, that was like, how do we tell stories around? I call them hybrid narratives, like where we combine the sociological and the personal around income inequality. And how do we make people want to listen to those stories? So that we try to do that with the podcast as well as like an extension of it.
So how did you move from your first two books were, I think, you know, mostly child related or, you know, issues related to children. And then later on, you went on to do much more economic work, you know, parental per se, you know, family as a unit. Can you talk about that transition, like how you, from children issues to maybe the economy?
Broader ones? I think, I am interested in families, and so it's not that different. But also, you know, the further you get away from childhood, the more you become the sort of preachy parent rather than the, like it for Branded, I went undercover into schools, you know, I was like much closer to the people I was writing about, you know, I was nine, 10 years older than they were, you know? So, I had a lot more in common with them than I did with their parents. Right. And I think that starts to change and it's hard to be an older person writing convincingly from the adolescent perspective, right? So there's that. I also think there was a tendency in the 90s and the noughts to get women and to kind of pigeonhole women into writing about kids and motherhood. And I actually wasn't a parent at that time either. And, you know, it was sort of, this was my, I felt like it was a way I could sell a serious book, honestly, about how commercial culture influences us by making it about adolescence or making it about children. Because that was what the market sort of expected of female journalists. But I think that's changed.
Mm-hmm.
So some of it is like, I don't think we have to position ourselves as much, that there's sort of like a mommy corner for political writing for women. I think that has changed. And also mm-hmm. the recognition that mommy corner is actually extremely political. Like, not only were we sort of sometimes relegated to write about parenthood or kids in earlier periods, but that writing itself was not taken as seriously as it should have because that issue was being minimized. But I think especially now with the Biden administration and pandemic and the recognition of the care economy and the recognition of human infrastructure as one of the most important issues of our day, you know, whatever Joe Manchin thinks, that has changed. And we are now going to be able to have a real political respect and conversation about economics around parenthood and economics around family life and personal lives. That personal finance has also often been so apolitical and corrupt, right? And I think personal finance writing can be a place of, again, very radical thought. And messaging to people.
Mm-hmm. So you have written multiple articles as well. So when I was going through your second book, Hot House Kids, you had also written this article called Extreme Parenting, I think, for The Atlantic. Did the book come out because of that article, or were you already kind of...
No. It was the excerpt. It was called It's the First Serial.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Okay. Also, I did notice that your first and second book came out, I think, in a span of 3 years. I think 2003 or 4, your first book came out in 2006. Mm-hmm. Hot House Kids had come out. But your next book, I think, Republic of Outsider, came out in 2012, if I'm not wrong, which took you...
Yeah, 2013. 2013. Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons for that, including I had a kid. So, yeah. Oh. And, you know, got married and, you know, I had a whole, I had a job, you know, or like life stuff happened. But I also think, I think I was just realizing I wasn't, because I felt like I pigeonholed myself into writing about kids and I fought against it and made it as serious and political and literary as I could, but I realized I wanted to start out writing about writing in different ways, stuff that was sort of rigorous from the beginning, but I didn't have to hide the ideas. You know what I mean? That it didn't have to be, oh, this is a book for parents. Instead, this is a book for everybody that pertains to parents, you know? And that took a while to sort of re-center my career in that way and my interests and my confidence. So, and I did, and it really did change me. And then I wrote like two books of poetry. I mean, I've been doing all this other stuff.
So finally, I have a few questions. Finally it flows. I just have one question on the Hot House Kids again, which is, mm-hmm. You are a gifted child as well. I'm just wondering, at what point did you decide that, you know, you were going to, I think the Hot House Kids has a personal element as well. Since you were a gifted child, you had that experience growing up as well. Stop me if I'm wrong, but when did you decide that you wanted to channel that into a separate project? And
when did I want to chat? I don't know. I mean, I still feel like I haven't even gone to the bottom of that whole culture around that. I mean, I was talking to my friend around. I mean, I feel like there were different kinds of giftedness I was getting at in the book. And they all interested me. You know, one was, again, sort of branded, commercialized giftedness that was sort of products sold to people and classes and whole regimens that were just like ways to kind of sop parental money, right? And to use their anxiety. So that was one thing that interested me. And then mm-hmm. the second thing that interested me were what happened to the former actual prodigies, the kids who were, you know, bona fide, brilliant, what happens to them later in life. So I talked to a lot of them, and that was also very interesting to me. And the third was, you know, what about when someone's just gifted and, but that's kind of it. And yet they were sort of talked into this position in life because that was seen as a goal to be seen as promising when you're young. That was reflected well on the parents. But honestly, there's nothing to do. Very few prodigies become geniuses, and very few just merely promising people actualize that promise. So what happens later, and what is there about that formation? And there's a ton of novels about it, right? Frankenstein is actually, in some ways, could be read as a novel about a gifted child. things often mm-hmm. go wrong. Things often go wrong in parenting in general, right? But the process of trying to build somebody to be a champion or just simply to build them to be special can be toxic. And it can also, it is very literary because it's sort of an unreplicable thing. It's like you'll never go back to the time where you were that great. It's very unlikely for someone to ever achieve the renown, you know, that they did as a child pianist, as an adult pianist, just because there isn't the kind of space in the world for that. You know, mm-hmm. there's only one chair in the orchestra. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas in their school, they were the most brilliant kid to ever be. So what does that do to them? And what does that do to their family and the family dynamics? So it was all very, and then the fourth thing, I guess, was the scams. And those were interesting too. Like there's a child painter who had been, basically her family had been scamming people. And I went to visit them, and she really, it was, I could not get her to paint. And that was another totally bizarre chapter, right? Like the parents were so invested in this that they would do anything, and they were making money off of it. So it was just, yeah, I was sort of interested in general about childhood, economics, culture, families, you know, same stuff.
Right. So finally, you were a film critic, I think, before you became a journalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have any good movie recommendations for us today?
Oh, yeah. So everybody likes this. Not everybody, a lot of people, but I really like The Power of the Dog by Jane Campion. But okay. I'd love to recommend her earliest films. If you like The Power of the Dog, it's called Sweetie. And then the other one was called Angel at My Table. And it's really wonderful films. So those were quite old, and I highly recommend them.
Okay. Is that it? Any more recommendations? I mean, any
TV series? Any what?
Any TV series that you are?
Yes, TV. Yeah, absolutely. Occupied, which is a wonderful Norwegian series about Norway being invaded by the Russians. It's really great. It's not much else to say about it, except it's like Nordic, Scandi stuff.